What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
The nature of the 1987 upheaval with racial and ethnic differences coming to boiling point when the Tokay of the time felt there was also no other way.
And that's Fiji Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka there testifying before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission about the coup he led in 1987. Now, would you work for free, say 8 hours a week? Seems like Palau workers will have to in the new year. And Papua New Guinea is calling for urgent help from security forces following attacks on local fishermen.
Really need to protect that, not because of piracy only, but because of illegal gun smuggling and drug trade. We have to protect the both sides of the borders.
And who came out victorious at the Dubai Sevens? You'll find out very shortly. All those stories here on Pacific Beat, where we come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. On Nisan Bulivinaka, Manuela Tainyao, Hafa Ade and Gupla Morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, and I'm your host, Aggie the Bowl. I hope you had a great weekend, and if you didn't know, it's the 1st of December, so there's only 24 days away to Christmas. Know that our team will be with you throughout the festive season, bringing you the latest in news and views. Let's get on with it. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start the show this morning by looking at an event that happened some 38 years ago when an unknown military officer, Sitiveni Rambuka, took over Fiji's government by force. This report from the 14th of May 1987 by the ABC's PM program.
This morning, 38-year-old Colonel Sitiveni Rambuka led 10 armed soldiers into the Fijian parliament and shepherded out the prime minister, elected only 4 weeks ago, Dr. Timothy Bavandra, and his 27 cabinet ministers. The army strongman announced he'd suspended the constitution, the chief justice, the commander of the army, and the chief of police. The Australian and New Zealand governments have refused to recognise the military takeover, and Mr. Hawke condemned the coup in parliament today. Fiji's sacked military leader, Brigadier Nailatitku, is meeting Mr. Hawke for talks, and in Suva, the coup leader, Colonel Rambuka, told journalists why he'd taken such arbitrary action.
And that was coup leader Colonel Sitiveni Rambuka speaking on that fateful day in 1987. So why is this back in the news? Well, last Friday, Mr. Rambuka, now Prime Minister Rambuka, testified before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and was questioned about who was behind the coup and his motives on that day. Although he didn't name names, he did speak plainly about what drove him to stage a military takeover.
It was, if I can call it that, a contained disturbance, and the word you have used in the question here, violent imposition of will, I cannot deny that, because in the army, violence is the use of weapons, whether the weapon is loaded or not. You also used in the first statement here, preemptive strike. I felt that it was a preemptive action, prevent any worse situations if that had not happened. The nature of the 1987 upheaval was a straightforward racial one, ethnic differences, coming to boiling point when the Tokay of the time felt there was also no other way to draw the attention, serious attention, of the authorities, not only here but also abroad, particularly in England, to see what is now happening. Perhaps they did not foresee when our constitution was drawn up. I believe it was a natural concern, carry over from the security of monogeneous society, slowly metamorphosing into a multi-ethnic society, which had become dominated by other ethnic groups. Perhaps that is an explanation, not justification, an explanation of what happened. How we saw, or I saw, things developing, and what I could do to stop it from deteriorating.
What were your feelings or thoughts as the events following the 1987 political upheaval unfolded around you?
I knew that the responsibility was on my shoulders. I had to make sure that all my subordinate commanders knew what we had to do. Nothing harmful individually, that we would not harm any person. Everyone on the seat, we had to be sure, did not have a loaded weapon. They carried ammunition, but no loaded weapon. We just couldn't risk anyone using their weapons to harm the unarmed civilians.
And that's Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka there responding to questions at the Reconciliation Commission. Now, Lede Movono is the ABC's reporter in Fiji and attended the hearing. I asked her about the significance of Mr. Rambuka's appearance before the commission.
Agnes, I think there was a lot of anticipation and eagerness. People had been looking forward to the opportunity for Sitiveni Rambuka, the man that almost everyone in this country attributes to with the problematic political past that we've sometimes had since the 14th of May 1987, when he took over the government at gunpoint while being a very senior officer in what was then the Royal Fiji Military Forces. So today, only journalists and a few officials were allowed at the Novotel Convention Center in Lami, a township away from the capital, Suva, to listen to the Prime Minister give what everyone had hoped would be the truth to who really was behind the 1987 coup, and to provide an explanation. It will be disappointing to the people of Fiji who have been looking forward to that revelation to come through, but Sitiveni Rambuka did not divulge who was behind him in his takeover of the Fijian government of Dr. Timothy Mbavandra in May of 1987.
And that's ABC's Fiji reporter, Lede Movono, speaking to me there following Sitiveni Rambuka's testimony before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Now, the commission has an enormous task ahead of it to pull together a report by October of next year on the cases, or causes rather, of Fiji's past political upheavals, which includes three coups, two of them by military and a civilian one. Now, as the holiday season approaches and many across the Pacific face a cost of living crisis, the last thing you want to be asked by your boss is to work for free in the new year. Well, Palau's government has issued a notice asking government workers to volunteer 8 hours of labour per week, which may or may not be paid in the future. Now, joining us this morning is Palau's President Sarangal Whips Jr. With that, I do say good morning, Mr. President. Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us and fronting up, to be able to answer these questions. Firstly, Mr. President, why is Palau asking workers to volunteer their time?
Well, in Palau, we don't have a parliament where the leader of the parliament is the leader of the government. We have a separate Senate and House. And in order for us to run the government, we have to have a budget that passes through both houses, and then the president signs it. Unfortunately, and that's supposed to be done before the every fiscal year, which is begins October 1st. What happened in this fiscal year is our Congress, the Senate and the House, could not pass a budget. So they passed what they call a continuing budget authority, which only allowed for 3 months. And so that means it'll expire December 31st. But on a continuing budget, it only gives you the level of funding as the year before. But in this year's law, it also requires a 10% increase in government salaries. So that means beginning October 1st, all the government employees' salaries went up by 10%. What happens is now as we're approaching the end of this quarter, which is December 31st, is that 10% increase is now affecting the budget so that we legally will not be able to spend money. So to ensure that the people continue to get some salary, we're asking them that we go to 72 hours. The following week, it may go to 64 hours. And then, the following month, if they don't pass a budget, it'll go to zero. Somewhat similar to what happened in the United States, where President Trump had to ask workers to volunteer until they pass a budget, and then we have to repay them. But of course, that's up to Congress. They have to pass the law. And really, it's also a message to our Congress that they need to act. They cannot continue to leave the people and the government employees working in limbo. But we have to be honest. We have to do what legally we're required to do to ensure that government operations continue, that hospital remains open, you know, police go to work. And that's why we issued that request.
Mm. Mr. President, as you said, you know, the Senate, the House, they could not pass the budget. But how essentially did the Palau government even get into this situation?
Well, I think ultimately, I was on a talk show in Palau talking about it. It's the inability of both houses to compromise. The House, we have a process where it has to go through three readings in each house. And once that is done, if they can't agree, then what they call a conference committee, where they have to iron out their differences. And I think the main challenge was the House had most of their, that what we call have nothing to do with the budget, taken out. But the Senate insisted on items that really are not part of the budget, but were in the budget bill. And then a lot of, we call them extra baggage. And I think their insistence on those being in caused the lack of the ability to compromise, because ultimately it needs to be sent to me. And if I don't agree to those, I have to send it back to them. So it is unfortunate that we're in this situation, and it continues. So we did, after the letter was issued, the Senate and House did begin meetings. The good news is they tell me that they will have something on my desk Monday or Tuesday. So we're hopeful that they've now reached a point where they can agree on some issues, and it'll come to me. Hopefully those are some things that I can accept. Otherwise, I would have to send it back to them.
Yeah, President, basically, are you asking workers to literally bail out the government? Would that be an accurate, because I'm wondering, the reaction from workers, they must be frustrated at this request.
Oh, absolutely. When Congress fails to do their job, they're totally frustrated. And the public, is frustrated, because if an ambulance runs out of fuel and can't go pick up a patient, that's a Congress problem when they can't pass a budget. So, these are things that I have been reminding the Congress that The unfortunate part is there's money. That's the sad part of this whole situation. We ran a surplus last year. The spending that's projected for next year will be the amount that we collected this year. So this is what I propose to Congress. So it's not a lack of money. It's the lack of legal authority, which only Congress can give me, to spend the money. And so that falls squarely on Congress's failure to do their job.
Mr. President, would love to know, will you be leading by example, though? Will you volunteer 8 hours of work per week?
Oh, yeah, it's everybody. It's across the board.
Okay. And it is a big ask, though, for the workers, right? I mean, do you think there's a bit of a political risk in it? I mean, doesn't it make you vulnerable to political criticism from your opponents?
Well, I think what's more important is that we continue as long as we can, and so we're asking the people. But you know, if Congress passes the law next week and we're able to sign it, or not that next week, today or tomorrow, then nobody has to volunteer anything. But that's what we're waiting for them to do. And sometimes, you know, democracy is messy. I think, unfortunately, maybe we learned a little bit from the way the U.S. had to go on a 42-day shutdown. But unlike the U.S., which can continue to operate and then, I guess, go back and pay people, we don't have that option in our laws. So it's even worse. And so that's why when we do run out of money, we have to ask them to volunteer to work indefinitely, and which a lot of the government workers in the U.S. had to do the same thing. So this is the unfortunate challenge that we have in a presidential system versus a parliamentary system.
Mm. I mean, are you confident, though, that they will pass the budget? And if they do, how long do you think this arrangement will have to go on for?
Well, I think if they don't pass a budget, the public is going to ask them to be stepped down and maybe be impeached, because they cannot let this go on. This is not acceptable. And we experienced this right at October 1st. So technically, the government was shut down for about 8 hours because they didn't do their job. So we're hoping that we don't face the same issue again.
Yeah. Mr. President, before we let you go, though, I do want to just sort of switch gears. You know, I want to go towards, you know, COP31. The Pacific didn't get it, but there is a pre-COP leaders meeting in the region. I'm just wondering, are you going to put your hand up for Palau to possibly host?
Well, I think first of all, we thank Australia and the whole Pacific for really sticking together and pushing for a COP in the Pacific. And unfortunately, we weren't able to get that because of Turkey's stubbornness. However, what we need to focus on is how can we still make the people of the world understand the challenges that we face in the Pacific. So, you know, Palau is hosting PIF next year. We'd like to see something that leads up to COP happen out of PIF. I think we should have every opportunity to engage the world with the Pacific. And a PIF and a pre-COP, I think, are great opportunities for us to do that. So really, I think bringing COP to the Pacific is pre-COP to the Pacific is important. And, you know, we want to work with our Pacific brothers to see how we can make sure that that's the we can achieve the best outcome.
Yeah. Are you aware, Mr. President, of how that will be decided as to who will host that pre-COP?
Well, I think we'll have to have a discussion definitely probably at the Troika level and then bring it back to the leaders to discuss. But I think the most important thing that we have is that we have a united Pacific. We're strong in our voice, and that's what we need to maintain. So we already went through the COP31 deciding who is going to host the COP, and unfortunately, it didn't seem like it was consensus-based, and it ended up being, well, if I don't get it, then, you know, nobody should get it. And that we don't want to get in that situation. Mm-hmm. What we want to do is let's have a unified voice. Let's do what's best for the Pacific. you know, let's make sure that Pacific issues are known. So how do we do that? Let's work together to find the best way of making leaders that we invite to our region understand that.
Absolutely. So. Well, look, thank you very much, President, for always showing up and sharing insights, especially around this whole 8 hours possible free labor for next year. But hopefully that budget gets sorted.
Well, no, that's not next year. That starts this next
That's period. Right. Yes.
Well, yeah, next year it goes to zero if they don't pass. So, yeah.
Thank you again.
So that's why, thank you. Okay.
That is Sarangal Whips Jr., President of Palau, speaking to us here on Pacific Beat. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Now we head to Papua New Guinea, where the mayor of Daru Island is calling for urgent help from security forces following attacks on local fishermen. The island, located on the border with both Australia and Indonesia, was the site of a public riot after fishermen were robbed at gunpoint by armed thieves. Mayor Samuel Wingu says the suspects are now in custody, but more needs to be done to protect the island's fishermen and residents from sea pirates.
They were on their way back. Just before arriving at reaching Daru, they were intercepted by others with guns and confiscated all their products, and they let the output motors with the fishermen empty-handed. They came into Daru, and they went and up to the police station. They reported the matter, and they went back home, and they regrouped, and they started going on rampage. I don't know what forced them to go on a rampage, but we have a lot of opportunists hanging around looking for reasons to attack anything and that they can lay their hands on to grab. They vented out their frustrations on what had happened. They should have, waited for police to intervene to check on what was reported at the police station, but they took it upon themselves and they went on a riot, attacking innocent business houses and private properties.
Did we find out, who did this to the locals? Who apprehended them out in the sea and took all their bags. Was that ever found out?
They have found out. They have not actually confirmed, but they have arrested some boys and they are now at the police station.
And does this create a concern for the locals that live on the island, especially with sea piracy? Is sea piracy one of those things that people need to be concerned about?
Yes, I think the policing of the waters is very important, very critical. Those responsible for providing surveillance along the coastline and into even the borders between Australia, Papua New Guinea, as well as Western into Gulf and Western into Indonesia. There was not so much surveillance being carried out. I think on the Australian part, it is okay, but on our part, on our side, on the Western province, PNG side, always, we don't have the capacity and the capability to provide surveillance 24/7, and that greatly affects. We have had a lot of dinghies that have gone missing with passengers in them that traveling from Daru to Gulf and Gulf to Daru for transportation of pearl nuts and other stuff. Or people trying to seeking access into Port Moresby through Gulf, they have gone missing a lot of times. A lot of output models have gone missing. Even after they go missing, surveillance of the rescue operations carried out. It does not happen on time to be able to save or to rescue. Yeah, that area. I think we need to our national government and the provincial governments, especially national governments. I think they have to look into it to strengthening that surveillance of our waters. It's a huge concern, and we know actually lost a lot of people. And even the waters between Australia and Papua New Guinea, those are our fishing places, so we really need to protect that, not because of piracy only, but because of illegal gun smuggling and drug trade. We have to protect both sides of the borders.
And that's Samuel Wingu, Daru Town Mayor, speaking to reporter Godwin Eke. Stay tuned because your news wrap is up just in a moment here on Pacific Beat.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
Now, the Arona Cup, Sharks versus the Roosters, I did say that I would
Arona Cup every week, man. Honestly, yeah, it was just the grand final of the week. Now, I swear, I don't know how many times we played for this cup.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hold the front page!
Kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DuBois, and it's the time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines, and that's always brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans. I've got to say, good morning, sir, and how was your weekend?
It was very busy, actually, Aggie. We had I attended a first birthday party.
Those are the best. Did you take all the lollies?
Oh, look, I mean, they're essentially just the sequel to the wedding, aren't they? You know, I think it feels like the party's just as big sometimes, although the child, I don't think, will ever remember it. But we all had a great time.
And, nice.
It was actually my anniversary yesterday, but it's like we're in that awkward period now where now that we're married, but we still celebrate the anniversary of where we met.
Oh, look
so
at you.
I don't know how much longer we're going to do that
I loved
for.
It.
It's like, what do we
keep
do
doing
now?
It. That's how you're married. Just going to stay. You're going to stay together as having those anniversaries. I love it. Okay. Well, look, we've got headlines all around the Pacific. This first one, though, very unfortunate. 8 people have been killed following a landslide in Tahiti. What do we know?
That's right, Aggie. So 8 bodies have been claimed after they were buried by a landslide on Tahiti's main island in the early hours of Thursday morning last week. So it struck several homes in the southeast of the island in Afa'iti Taravo'o, which is a village located at the foot of a large hill. About 200 emergency staff as well as an army helicopter spent a whole day and night combing the affected area.
Wow.
However, none were pulled from the rubble, unfortunately, and tragically one of the victims was a 3-year-old girl.
Do we even know, Carl, what caused the landslide?
Well, it looks like torrential rain had just destabilized the earth to the point that search operations had to stop due to the risk of more landslides and even the collapse of the whole portions of the mountain. Like, they'd just been soaked through that much. The French High Commissioner, meanwhile, has said an investigation for manslaughter has been launched to try and establish the cause.
Wow.
And whether the affected buildings actually met the dwelling and construction standards in that area. So we'll see what happens.
A big call. Yeah, absolutely. Well, love and prayers going out to those in Tahiti. We head to the Marshall Islands, though. They've introduced the world's first universal basic income scheme. What is this?
Yeah, very interesting this one, Aggie. So the government has announced a UBI system on Wednesday with blockchain as its main mode of delivery. So
okay.
Blockchain meaning crypto, essentially. So it's the first time a system of this kind has been implemented anywhere in the world. And according to RNZ, it will see each citizen paid periodically an equal sum, regardless of how much they are making in salary. So that's going to amount to a US $800 a year per person. It's going to be paid out quarterly, and citizens will have the option of receiving their payment either in cash or by bank deposit or via a stable coin.
Okay, which I still have no idea how crypto works. But I'm wondering, is it stable going forward, though?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. I like you, I don't have a lot of literacy when it comes to cryptocurrency or blockchain. I've tried to have people explain it to me. I'll admit it doesn't seem to sink in. But basically, a stable coin is a cryptocurrency which is pegged to a real-world asset or groups. And in this case, it's US Treasury bonds, which tethers it to the US dollar. And what's interesting is people in the RMI don't actually need a bank account to access it. They can use a digital wallet, thus ensuring it reaches the remotest parts of the island where banking services aren't available. But to be honest, Aggie, I'm more interested to see, I guess, the ripple effects of this.
Mm.
Like, UBI as a concept has been around forever.
Yes.
You know, it's something sort of, you know, people used to joke about in the early 2000s. It always felt like a bit of a pipe dream.
Right.
But it's gained popularity in recent years as, you know, things like inequality and economic hardships have risen globally.
Mm.
However, the very nature of it, it's so controversial just because it's got a very perceived, you know, socialist nature.
Yeah.
And given how close the Marshalls are to the US ideologically, I'm very interested to see how something like this is going to land and if it can be implemented in other areas around the globe.
Yeah, I do know New Zealand has, there's been some certain parties that have asked for the UBI too, considering, as you said, global crises with living costs and everything. So, yeah, totally understand. Okay, well, let's head to sport because the PNG Hunters, they've announced their pre-season squad for the 2026 Queensland Cup season.
Yes, and haven't they had some turnover, Aggie? With 4
yes.
players, Gairo Voro, Epel Kayanapis, Robert Matthias, and Finley Glare, all departing for Darren Lockyer's
right.
new London Broncos. Meanwhile, Solo Wane and Judah Rimbu have also departed to play with the Brisbane Tigers. So that's a fair chunk of their core group from last season, which is all of a sudden just gone. However, the Hunters are taking it in full stride with a very much a glass half full approach, saying that while the departures will hurt them in the short term, it is going to open up some slots for some exciting new young players coming through. They've nice. Mentioned a few of those guys, Carlos Lung, Kevin Yucco, and Jaron Pitten, a red-hot trio from the Lacenacks Tigers, grand final winning squad in the Digicel Cup. Apparently those three are pretty good and are ready to make the jump to the Queensland Cup. Meanwhile, there's some exciting young new halves, Felix Becky, Joel Genner, and apparently they're going to help fill the void left by Voro. And they'll also have a couple of veterans in Benji Cott, Koso Bundy, and Elijah Rolatinga. They're all on track to return from injuries as well.
Well, look, I mean, we spoke about this last week, the fact that the new owner of the London Broncos, Darren Lockyer, now has another BNG player that's joined the team. Who was it?
That's right. Forward Jeremiah Simbikin has joined the squad, joining the five other PNG players, which have already been announced in the British capital. Unlike the others, he does have a lot of experience in the UK, having played most recently for the Castleford Tigers in the English Super League. So he's got that experience of the competition that they're going to be trying to get promoted to. So I'm sure that's going to help them a great deal. Really exciting. There's also been some word that Nana McDonald might sign, although I haven't heard, haven't seen that officially come through yet. But at the moment, so
PNG it looks like they're players gonna, seem gonna, to be yeah. making up their London Broncos.
They're going to start the season with very much a PNG-led side in the biggest city in Europe. So can't wait for that.
Love that. Okay, as always, Carl, really appreciate you coming through with the headlines around the Pacific here on our News Wrap.
Thank you, Aggie.
Well, that was your headlines. And look, if you're new to Pacific Beat, welcome. I'm your host, Aggie Tupol. I'm just going to go through a quick recap of what's been on the show so far. We had a Fiji PM, Sitiveni Rampuka, who has testified before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but still no reveal as to who was behind the coup he led in 1987. We spoke with President of Balau, Sarangal Whips Jr., about working for free. That's right, about 8 hours a week is what the government is going to be implementing very shortly. But yes, so Palau workers will be doing that before the end of the year. Also, Papua New Guinea is calling for urgent help from security forces following attacks on local fishermen. And still to come, the New Zealand Defence Force confirmed 85 Cook Island soldiers, they're eligible for service medals for the Second World War. And we talk about who came out victorious at the Dubai Sevens. The New Zealand Defence Force and researchers have confirmed 85 Cook Island soldiers are eligible for service medals for the Second World War. The efforts to honour the soldiers has been headed up by Kate Walker, the lead of the Cook Islands Military History Research Project team. She's been working with the New Zealand Defence Force over the past 6 months to identify the soldiers and their families. She told Lucy Cooper many of the soldiers served in the local military but missed out on medals as they were discharged before the end of the war.
Now that I'm in Rarotonga for a month, we are now pushing out onto our Facebook page, bit by bit, names. I'm not releasing them all at once because I would be inundated by people, but we will get through them. So I've already contacted with quite a number of descendants. So as soon as we confirm the identity of descendants, and obviously it needs to be number one, direct descendants, preferably living children, and there are a number, or their children. So there is a pecking order, I suppose you could call it. And yes, so I've had huge response already here to the maybe 15 names or so that we've released out of the 85 on our list who are due to receive their medals, and most of them are due to receive two medals. So that's the majority of the 85.
What do these medals represent? What are they getting them for?
So it depends on their length of service. Most of these men are due the War Medal 1939 to 1945 and the New Zealand War Service Medal. There is also another medal. There's only two men that qualify for that, and some of the men only qualify for one medal. This is for their service in the Rarotonga Local Defence Force, which was set up here as a territorial militia in April 1941, was disbanded in September 1945. And with oversight, of course, by New Zealand, because it was the Cook Islands were under their administration at that time. Yeah, there's about, we believe, about 170 Cook Islands men who served in the World War II Local Defence Force here in Rarotonga. We're still researching and getting more information and names as more documents come to light. And look, while it's nice that they're getting these medals, we've got to remember this is 80 years later.
Right, and so why didn't they receive these medals in the first place?
These men, most of them were discharged incorrectly because when the Cook Islands Local Defence Force reverted to a smaller territorial force and went part-time, these men were given the option to be discharged, which a lot did. But it was recorded in these documents, medal documents, that they refused duty and they were denied their medals, which is incorrect.
And do you think it's something that also these families may not be aware of the service?
Yeah, definitely. I phoned a family the other day, or put it up on our Facebook page. There was actually three brothers who were denied their medals. They're the only ones that we have that were brothers. Three. We have a number that were brothers, but we have three brothers. And I've contacted all the close descendants, a number here in Rarotonga. None of them knew. So, like I say, these World War II Local Defence Force servicemen, there was potentially a feeling of shame. They didn't receive their medals and they were just pushed aside, so they didn't tell anybody about it. But I would say 95, if not more, percent of the people I'm speaking to, and I've spoken to plenty already, they had no idea whatsoever that these men served in the Cook Islands Local Defence Force here in Rarotonga in World War II.
What does this whole situation say to you, Kate, about the treatment of Cook Islands soldiers?
Well, Lucy, it makes me wonder why it's taken 80 years and our tiny little team to quickly, as soon as we started the World War II research and started looking at these documents, thought, hang on a second, this is not adding up. There's something wrong here. So I think the whole discharge process was very poorly managed, and that's obvious. And, I mean, I have hundreds of pages of documents now on this, some that no one would have ever seen, and there's a lot of different aspects to this as well. And they're definitely at that time, and that was the way. There wasn't an equality with their service. So that's what I mean. I think the New Zealand Defence Force and Veterans Affairs can really step up now and say, yeah, no, they deserve these medals.
And that's Kate Walker, the lead of the Cook Islands Military History Research Project team. Now to sport now. Fiji's claimed a podium finish in the opening round of the 2025 World Rugby Sevens Series in Dubai. Fiji beat France 24-7 to claim bronze, while New Zealand weathered an Australian fight back to win their first stage since Singapore last year. Let's take a quick listen to Fiji's bronze medal match.
George Mboze with a big hit and a runaway. Big George is being run down here by Perez. One more fend might do it. He pops it up, though, to Jerry Matana. Here's the offload to Nunduvalo, who ran in three tries in the semi-final. Sefo on the chase, but you won't catch Viwa. Mentioned centre fly half in 15. He's got plenty of game. Bouye, try already, leaves it behind. Fiji are onto it like a flash. Terry Valawa skips away. Oh, those bright fluoro boots like a blur. Here come Fiji again. Here comes the predator, Manuel Maisamoa. He's away, he's clear, and under the bar.
What an effort out of Fiji. Six players on the pitch and they hold out a strong French squad.
Fiji take bronze in Dubai.
Now that audio is courtesy of Stan Sport. But meanwhile, the Fijiana, they just missed out on a bronze after losing their third playoff to Japan. Now to find out how it all played out, we are joined by publisher of the online rugby magazine, Te Vovo, Kauden Kamea. With that, I say Bulubinaka, Kauden.
I'm Bulubinaka.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. We have to start off with the men. Three wins, two losses. I mean, how did you rate their return to the short format?
Yeah, I thought they looked good. I thought they looked good. New, you know, new system, new competition structure. And every game, you've got to be up for every game, a game at every game. And I thought Fiji looked good. Their losses were very narrow. Some of the wins were narrow as well, but they looked good. They looked, you could see the maturity in the team, the caps. Mm. So the players looked good. I thought they had good speed, good D, and played very well.
Yeah. Carlton, you know, one of their losses, you know, came against eventual stage winners, New Zealand in the semi-finals. But what do you think went wrong for them in that game?
Oh, look, New Zealand, you've got to beat them. You know, that's just what matters in the end. You have to beat New Zealand to win the title. And I thought the boys did good enough in there. New Zealand had a couple of Fijian boys in their team as well. Rocco Solia was devastating. A couple of times he handled, and his try assist resulted in, you know, the margin in the end.
You know, speaking of New Zealand, though, you know, they look to be back, right, after finishing seventh in last year's overall standings. Are they posing as a big threat again?
Oh, yeah, they're always, you know, they've got some great talent coming through. Young Brady Rush, the boy Kele Lasanga, a new Fijian boy that they've picked. And the older guys are just full of life. You know, they're still going strong. And they didn't win a tournament all of last season, so it's overdue. And they played well enough. They beat Fiji to get through to the final against Australia. And that was it. It's very, very close.
Well, let's look at last year's overall winners. You know, meanwhile, Argentina looked very poor. I mean, what do you put that down to?
No, actually, yeah, on and off. I think, you know, first tournament, they're going to get better as they go. They looked good in patches. I thought they just ran out of steam against Fiji in the end. They could have won that game too with the ball in hand, you know, less than 10 seconds to go. They were trying to score the winning try. So it's all, you know, first tournament, first run for all these teams. A lot of some new players on debut are all around the park. Very impressed with a couple of the young Aussies. But Argentina will be back, mark my word.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, like, you know, with both New Zealand and Australia last year, why do you think they struggled, though?
Oh, you know, sevens is a confidence game. If you start losing a couple of games, a couple of tournaments, a couple of close ones, you know, the players maybe start doubting themselves, number one. Number two, I think both New Zealand and Australia have gone through a couple of years of rebuilding. It's really hard because, you know, you've got some old Fijis, got that right now. You know, we've got Mwadhinadhangi and Talidolo, two of the old players, very tall forwards, the lanky traditional Fijian forward. They're well into their 30s. I don't know if there's anyone around here in Fiji able to fill the gap, so they keep going back. And I think, you know, you make the mistake, 1 year too long is 1 year too long. And I think Australia and New Zealand suffered a bit with that and held on to a couple of players maybe a season too long. It's easier said than done to do that. And I think they suffered as a result, but they're looking good. They've got some young new players in both sides. And, you know, if they click, they make it. If they don't, well, you struggle on for until you find the right mix.
Mm. Colin, I want to chat now about the women, though. You know, like Fijiana, they won their opening two games. You feel like that was an encouraging tournament for them?
Yeah, absolutely. I was really impressed with their wins. First time ever against USA and then to back it up against France. I just thought, yeah, so the first two games were really good for them. They look good, got speed around the park, and which they've lacked over the last season or so. They just came apart in the end, you know, at the end of day two. Again, it's a conditioning thing. As much as you can train and practice, when you get into a tournament, you know, all the nerves and the pressure adds to the stress of the tournament. The physical stress. And so I think they just fell apart a bit, especially against Japan in the end there.
Mm. I mean, yeah, look, they've slowly improved over the course of last season. Do you think we could possibly see them claim a stage this year?
Yeah, absolutely. They're good enough. They were, you know, they, as I say, to beat USA and then beat France. And they were in the game against New Zealand up until halftime, and then just fell apart a bit. But in their last pool game on day one. They're a young team, and they've got, you know, coming through a rebuilding phase. But I think their conditioning is the weakness. They missed some tackles right down the middle, very easy tackles, I felt. And so it's just a matter of conditioning.
Mm. Well, okay, so when will the next stage of the event take place?
This coming weekend in Cape Town in South Africa, where the Fiji men pooled with South Africa, with the defending champions Great Britain and New Zealand. So it doesn't come any easier. Fijiana in the pool against New Zealand, USA and Great Britain. So it's, tough. There's no quarterfinals. Every game is actually a quarterfinal. So
wow. Yeah.
You've got to win the pool to get through, yeah.
That will be exciting to watch. Look, I have to ask, Alden, early days, but who is your pick to claim the overall title?
Oh, Fiji. Fiji, New Zealand, one of the two. But, you know, there's Argentina. They're the best-looking team over the last couple of years. They've got the runs on the board. They've got the experience. They've got the stars. They're always going to be up there. It's way too early, but we'll see. You know, you've got a long series ahead, so they'll all have to keep coming back, regrouping, analyzing, and making improvements. And the margins are so fine now. I think this is just overall on the tournament. I think it's great. The format's tighter. Every game is a serious rugby sevens game, but I just kind of miss the flamboyance of the, you know, when you had in the good old days, you had Kenya, Papua New Guinea, even you had teams that just played a different style of sevens rugby, sometimes a bit of a cricket score, but that is all part of the excitement, I guess, of rugby sevens. Now it's a very serious competition.
Yeah, absolutely. Colin, it is always great to catch up with you. Really appreciate you coming on the show this morning.
Thank you.
No worries. That, of course, is publisher of the online rugby magazine Te Vovo, Colin Kamea, here on Pacific Beat, which it literally brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. You can find all our top stories when you type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. You can find us on our socials on Facebook and Instagram when you type ABC Pacific. We'll be back at same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nija Daily. As always, o tua whātua, you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.